Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Even a temporary pause in fighting in Ukraine has so far proved elusive.
Despite the peace negotiations that are going on, there doesn't seem to be a lull in Russian drone and missile strikes on Ukraine.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Different peace talks focused on eastern Congo are showing signs of progress. And in Mexico, pushback against TV ads discouraging immigration. They're sponsored by the U.S. government.
El spot contiene un mensaje discriminatorio.
The Mexican president calls the ads discriminatory and an attack on human dignity.
Plus, poisonous bites from rattlesnakes. They are not all equally venomous.
If they're really angry, they will dump a ton. If they're not so angry, they'll give you sort of a leave-me-alone bite and just inject a little bit of venom.
And that venom, it actually evolves.
All those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. There are many violent conflicts around the world, but one of them, at least, may be getting closer to a truce. We're talking about the fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The M23 rebel group, which is backed by Rwanda, has agreed to a ceasefire with the DRC.
The negotiations were hosted by Qatar, and they seem to be getting somewhere. Both sides say there is more work to do. Sonia Rolle is a reporter with Reuters who spent years in Congo.
It was a very difficult process, and they couldn't reach an agreement. This time, Qatar started with the two presidents of the country and managed to actually get them to sit together in Qatar. It was like 1 month ago, something like that. So it was a first, and it was something that was already astonishing for most observers because the two presidents were accusing each other of a lot of things, from backing rebellion, backing armed groups, to even like more personal attacks. And this meeting that was broke by Qatar between the two presidents make it possible for direct talks to actually start between M23 rebellion, so backed by Rwanda, and the DRC government. So that's the first step. There is a kind of ceasefire on the ground. There are still some fightings, but it's really reduced. But it's not only Qatar that is behind. We also hear that it's the US, actually, that are backing also that system. And they got involved, especially because there was a big tin mine that produced about like 6% of the global tin production that was under threat of M23. And that's when the US actually stepped in and put a lot of pressure on the two sides.
Well, after Rwanda denied many times that they were involved and backing M23, it now seems their role in this conflict has never been more clear, in part because they are participating in the peace talks. What have we learned about Rwanda's involvement in this conflict?
I mean, it was well documented by the UN group of experts that is briefing twice a year the UN Security Council. And basically, like, the support that Rwanda is offering to Congo is a technological support, from drones to jamming system to SHORAD defense systems to prevent drones from bombing or to intercept them. There are also like special forces from Rwanda that are there that are really helping in the attacks. They agreed to withdraw what they call their defense system, which is like the troops on the ground, and all the agreement and everything that was talked between Rwanda and Congo is basically about Rwanda withdrawing and Congo stopping having any contacts or even do operation against Rwandan rebels. So obviously, like, the group of experts is saying, like, they're way, way, way more involved than they're really backing M23.
I'm curious to know how Qatar fits into all of this, Sonia. How key were they to getting to this initial ceasefire deal?
They're key because actually they're very pretty much involved in Rwanda. What was difficult before was actually that it was not easy to get Rwanda to agree. At least that was what was said by the Congolese government.
There's also the issue of human rights violations, especially committed by the M23 rebels. Clearly documented are rape and summary executions of civilians. Will there be any accountability?
That's one of the things that the Congolese government is saying, actually, because the M23 was asking that several hundred prisoners were released. So all the people that basically were accused of helping Rwanda in some way. And what the Congolese government was saying is basically we cannot like give amnesty to all those people because we need like to have proper due process and so on. And some crimes were committed and people need to be held accountable. But actually, it's on both sides. There was rapes and human rights violation on both sides. Over the recent months, I mean, the number of rapes exploded. And that's what is happening when there is a conflict like that. You don't have any kind of orders or regulation, and the women and the children are the first victims.
Clearly, a lot of things to consider before we get to peace in eastern Congo. Sonia, what to you would be the next important step that might suggest a lasting truce could be reached and be sustained?
If we see either from the Qatari mediation or any of the African mediation, because there are also mediation on that side, get to the bottom of the conflict. So get to the real issue and not only stay on what will be the condition for them to talk. Who is going to facilitate those direct talks on really like all the real issue of that conflict, from land grabbing to looting of minerals to presence of foreign army on Congolese soil or foreign armed groups on Congolese soil, and all those matters that are really important.
Sonia Rolle is a reporter with Reuters who spent years in the Democratic Republic of Congo. She spoke with us today from Paris.
Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum is not happy about a controversial ad that's airing on national TV. The spots are produced and paid for by the Trump administration and warn migrants not to come to the U.S., and they have turned into a diplomatic flashpoint. From Mexico City, the world's TV's Isaiah has more.
A few weeks ago, millions of Mexicans started seeing an advertisement on national television networks. The ad features images of migrants trying to enter the U.S. by land or being arrested, and a message from the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem.
If you are considering entering America illegally, don't even think about it. Let me be clear. If you come to our country and you break our laws, we will hunt you down. Criminals are not welcome in the United States.
The ads are subtitled in Spanish and broadcast during prime time slots, including soccer matches and telenovelas. And now President Claudia Sheinbaum is speaking out against it. In recent months, she's been very accommodating to President Trump's demands to try to avoid potential tariffs. She deployed 10,000 troops to prevent migrants from reaching the border. Her government handed over dozens of cartel members to be tried in the U.S., and her administration allowed U.S. drones to fly over Mexican territory to hunt down more potential criminals. But in regards to the commercial, she drew a line.
El spot contiene un mensaje discriminatorio que atenta contra la dignidad humana y que
Sheinbaum condemned the ad as discriminatory and, quote, an attack on human dignity. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has defended the ads as part of a broader campaign to deter illegal immigration. The TV networks broadcasting the message in Mexico said there's nothing illegal in doing so. A legal loophole created in 2014 allowed such foreign advertisements without government approval. But Gabriel Sosa, an audience advocate and expert on public communication policies in Mexico, says what is illegal is the content of the ad.
Entonces son estigmatizantes porque ellos dan por hecho de que son criminales que distribuyen drogas.
He says the ad stigmatizes migrants as criminals and drug traffickers, promoting xenophobia and potentially inciting violence against them. And that is illegal. Ernesto Villanueva, an expert on communication law, says the ads engage in racial profiling.
No se ven rubios, blancos, de ojos azules. Y en función del color de piel, pues es la propensión a cometer un delito.
You don't see any white or blonde people in the ads, he says. And that means judging the propensity to commit a crime based on the color of your skin. That, he says, is also illegal in Mexico. Villanueva says TV networks could be held accountable for breaking the law. But for now, Sheinbaum moved to change legislation.
Vamos a cambiar la ley para que se prohíba que gobiernos extranjeros.
A reform to the communications law will now ban the dissemination of political propaganda from foreign governments on Mexican media platforms. And lawmakers across the political spectrum have rallied behind the ban, which is an unusual show of unity in a divided Congress. Legal experts say the law could go into effect in just a few days. For The World, I'm Tivisa Isea, Mexico City.
It's an unmistakable warning to back off. The flick of a rattlesnake's tail is scary for good reason. Its venom is a potentially deadly chemical cocktail. Every rattlesnake species has a different and constantly evolving venom recipe, shall we say, tailored to the snake's prey. Now, new research suggests those recipes are being rewritten by environmental changes. Mark Margris is a biology professor at the University of South Florida. He's written about this in the journal Evolution. Mark, for this study on rattlesnakes, I understand that you camped out along the beaches of 11 uninhabited islands in the Gulf of California in Mexico. Can you take us there? What was that landscape like?
Yeah, it's actually really varied. The southern end of the peninsula near Cabo, where lots of people like to vacation, it's a much wetter, much more tropical environment, lots of vegetation. And then as you move further north, you get into much drier, much more harsh environments. And the northernmost island we sampled is actually called Death Island. It had very little vegetation, very much looks like a moonscape.
You and your team collected venom from 83 different rattlesnakes. How do you safely collect rattlesnake venom to study it?
Everyone that sees it, I think, is actually rather disappointed. It's very procedural. You get the snake to crawl into a clear PVC tube. And then eventually we either let them crawl out the front of it on their own and bite into a urine collection cup, the same type of cup that you would use at the doctor's office. And if they won't bite on their own, then sometimes we'll use long forceps and grab them behind the head and kind of encourage them to bite a little bit. Because believe it or not, a lot of these snakes are fairly reluctant to bite.
And so whenever they bite, they release the venom.
Yes, they do. And they actually control how much venom they release. If they're really angry, they will dump a ton. If they're not so angry, they'll give you sort of a leave me alone bite and just inject a little bit of venom.
A leave me alone bite. So once you got that venom, you brought it back to your lab for analysis. What did you think that you would find about the differences in the venom among these different snakes?
What we expected was that snakes on larger islands would have more complex venom because one toxin may work really well against a lizard, may not work so well against a mammal because our physiologies are very different. So typically snakes with more complex diets have more complex venoms. But ultimately, we actually found the opposite pattern, that these snakes on these larger islands actually had simpler venoms. And that was sort of very surprising to us initially. But when we looked into it further, what we found was that while those larger islands did have more species, they also had more rattlesnakes, and they had more rattlesnakes of other species. And we think this was likely due to competition. And they did this sort of niche partitioning or specialization on different prey.
Which means that one type of rattlesnake maybe evolves venom that is really good at killing a lizard, where another type of rattlesnake develops venom that's really good at killing a mouse, something like that.
Yes, exactly.
Got it. So does this tell you anything about the resilience of these different species to environmental change where they live?
The motivation for this project was really to try to understand how organisms at large, not just snakes, evolve over fragmented landscapes. So we know that habitat fragmentation is occurring now at an unprecedented rate, and that is likely going to affect the evolutionary responses of the species impacted by that habitat fragmentation. So our idea was these islands, they're sort of analogies or proxies for fragmented landscapes.
So what does this tell you then about, for example, animals that are living in a forest surrounded by an uninhabitable city and their ability to adapt to those changing environments?
The question is, should you try to conserve a single large patch of habitat, or should you try to conserve several smaller patches, you know, in which is potentially better for conservation? And I think what our work highlights is that if you're going to consider that single large approach, you definitely need to think about competition. And that is not something that has traditionally been thought of when we're thinking of trying to conserve the Florida panther or even timber rattlesnakes in Massachusetts.
Biologist Mark Margris, his research demonstrates how rattlesnake venom adapts to different environments. I am both jealous and scared of his job.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that roughly 40% of farm workers are in the country without proper legal status. Now farmers are worried they could lose their workforce to increased deportation efforts. 40 years ago, the Reagan administration took a different approach. It offered nearly 3 million undocumented immigrants a path to legal status. From KUOW in Seattle, Ailish O'Neill reports on the lasting impact of that policy.
About 10 workers are gathered around a fire, putting foil packets of their lunches in. When they're done eating, four of them climb up on a high platform that's pulled slowly by a tractor between two rows of pink lady apple trees. The workers have pruning shears, and they snip carefully selected branches as they roll through the orchard.
These guys will know how to prune. They're trying to tailor it to what kind of crop we need that year.
Brad Carpenter is a fifth-generation family farmer in the Yakima Valley. He says some of these employees have worked here as long as he has, 4 decades in some cases.
These are valuable employees, but they're about my age, so we're getting old.
Old, or, you know, about 60.
It takes skill to prune apples. You don't just go out there and start whacking limbs, you know.
Carpenter and his family farm a sprawling 2,000 acres. Right now, it's the off-season, so they have only about 70 employees. But during harvest, the farm employs 300 to 400 people. They grow apples, cherries, and mostly hops. Carpenter says growing hops, like growing apples, requires skilled employees.
Hops have to grow up a string. And you watch these guys on these sleds, big tall platforms, in the hop fields during the spring, and they're tying the tops of the string to the wire. The folks that do that are very highly skilled.
In the mid-1980s, the U.S. government offered undocumented immigrants a path to gain legal status. This amnesty offered under the Reagan administration had certain requirements, including people had to be able to prove they weren't guilty of any crime and they'd been here at least 5 years. That's why the Carpenters got involved. Their employees asked them to sign paperwork to verify their employment history.
What we realized is that we needed to maintain our valuable employee base. And it proved to be very valuable to have those particular employees to have status. It wasn't politically driven. It was driven based on the value of our company and the betterment of our employees.
Carpenter estimates that about 50 workers, the majority of the farm's employees at the time, got amnesty. One of them was Felipe Avalos. Avalos says he found out about the amnesty on the radio and on television, and he jumped at the opportunity. He'd immigrated from Mexico to the U.S. in 1981 when he was 16 years old and found work at the Carpenter Ranches in May of that year. He'd arrived just in time, only 8 months before the cutoff.
Steve, he was with us at the interview.
Avalo says Steve Carpenter, Brad's brother, helped sign the paperwork and went with the employees to their interviews in the city of Yakima. The amnesty changed Avalos' life.
Pues ya sin miedo ya estaba uno ya justo trabajando ir a pasearse uno ya después.
Avalo says he didn't have to be scared anymore. He was comfortable working and going out afterwards. He'd gone 10 years without visiting Mexico, so when he got his papers, he went to see his parents and his siblings who'd stayed there.
He started with a temporary work permit, eventually got a green card, and now he and his wife and their five kids are all citizens. Offhandedly, he throws out that he hopes there's another amnesty. He says what happened in the 80s was first they deported the, quote, bad guys, and then they offered an amnesty. So he hopes that happens again. To be clear, there's no active discussion of that in D.C. these days. Abalo still works for the Carpenters. It'll be 44 years this May. He's been promoted to foreman, and he oversees all the orchards, apples, cherries, and peaches.
Most of my foremen went through that amnesty, and that's what got us to this point right now at the farm.
Colton Carpenter is Brad's nephew. He wouldn't say on the record if he thought the government should offer another amnesty, but he would say he's grateful for the 1986 one.
It's nice having that certainty. It's helped us out a ton. And like I said, there's a lot of good people out here, and that just kind of boosted them a little bit. Got them into a situation where they were able to better their lives and not have to worry about any issues with immigration.
The Carpenters did not want to tell me how they lean politically. And there's a reason growers are hesitant to talk about another amnesty.
That word is pretty politically toxic.
John Devaney is president of the Washington State Tree Fruit Association.
There's the perception of the fairness issue, that you know, should someone that did not wait in the line get granted the benefit.
Devaney says what growers want instead is something like a bill introduced in 2022 by Representative Dan Newhouse, a Republican who represents much of central Washington, including Yakima and the Tri-Cities. Newhouse's bill included increased border security and enforcement, but also a path for undocumented immigrants to obtain legal status. It would take 10 years, and applicants would have to meet a lot of conditions.
Something that's not just a blanket giveaway of some new privilege, but entails some conditions, you know, to continue to work in agriculture or to pay a processing fine, for example.
The H-2A guest worker program allows farms to bring in seasonal workers on temporary visas, and a lot of growers in Washington use it. But Devaney says the program doesn't work for a lot of smaller farms because it's expensive and highly regulated. And it's not a solution for the farm workers who live here, some of whom have worked on Washington's farms for decades.
There's people working in the industry now who may have initially entered the U.S. In a way they should not have, but they're doing jobs that Americans don't want to do, and that there is a cost of losing all of that experience in that current workforce.
So far, Devaney says, there haven't been big workplace raids, and growers have been offering trainings, letting their employees know that anyone who comes on the farm will have to present a warrant and will wait in the office to speak to the specific employee they've come for. Back on the Carpenter farm, Brad Carpenter says there's a long list of phone numbers of people looking for work in the farm's front office. The Carpenters don't use the guest worker program, he adds. Everyone they hire is a local. A local, but an immigrant. Spanish is the language of the fields. For The World, I'm Alicia O'Neill, Yakima Valley, Washington.
And now, let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Japan is facing a rice shortage. Tapping into the government stockpile earlier this year was not enough to solve the problem. Japan is now importing rice from South Korea for the first time since 1999.
As rice is to Japan, the baguette is to France. But on May 1st, their Labor Day, it is illegal for bakeries to be open. That's true for most businesses, and boulangerie do not meet the exception for vital services. That is much to the chagrin of one baker there. The Times reports he's been fighting an 80,000 euro fine for opening his shops on May Day a few years ago.
And in Ireland, dude, where's my car? A man in Cork was forced to find a parking spot way out in a residential neighborhood. The next morning, after a night out, he could not remember exactly what neighborhood. After weeks of searching for his car, he asked a local radio station for help. Listeners found the car within minutes.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The legend of St. George, you know, the Dragon Slayer, it is celebrated by Christians from different denominations all over the world. Yesterday was St. George's Day. In Spain's Catalonia region, it translates into a sort of literary Valentine's Day. Couples exchange roses and books by the millions. It's a celebration of language, literature, and love. This year was a wild success, but the language got a little complicated, as the world's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
To kick off Sant Jordi Day, as Catalans call it, the president of Catalonia picked a local author to cut the literary ribbon, as it were. His choice, best-selling writer Javier Cercas. The two best Catalan creations, Cercas told President Salvador Illa in a video podcast, are our classic toasted bread with tomato and olive oil and Sant Jordi. This day is unique in all of the world. The video chat released early on Sant Jordi Day was decidedly light fare, but for some Catalans, choosing Cercas was a slap in the face, because though Cercas lives in Catalonia and speaks Catalan, he writes exclusively in Spanish. A small but boisterous group of Catalans took to the streets of Barcelona yesterday evening to protest. For them, Spanish is like that dragon in the St. George legend.
Creiem que la supervivència del català està greument amenaçada.
Spanish is a huge threat to our Catalan language, said retired teacher Rosa Colloy. Our president is supposed to be defending Catalan, but he invites a writer who's never written a word in our language. In fact, she said, he's a militant Hispanist, a Cataloniaphobe. Cataloniaphobia would be a fear of all things Catalan. Cercas would deny that charge, but he has been a vocal critic of what's known locally as the Procés, the Catalan independence movement from Spain. The Procés culminated in 2017 with an illegal referendum on leaving the Spanish Union. That led to a brutal police crackdown and jail or exile for the separatist leaders. Since then, support for independence among Catalans has dropped and stayed well below 50%. The current Catalan government says it's working to bring Catalonia closer to the rest of Spain after years of tension.
Una festa inclusiva, tots ens, aquest un dia que tothom està al carrer, tothom està.
President Illa, in his chat with Cercas, repeated his vision of an inclusive Sant Jordi celebration with room for Catalan and Spanish. But for Catalan language defenders, that's code for sidelining their tongue. University student Jordi Romero was at yesterday's protest, draped in a red and yellow striped Catalan flag. He said Catalan speakers suffer daily affronts that are slowly but steadily marginalizing them.
La última sentencia del 25, l'obligatorietat del 25% de classes en castellà.
For example, he cites a recent Supreme Court decision ordering public schools to teach at least 25% of classes in Catalonia in Spanish. Currently, Spanish is taught for just 90 minutes a week. If you stop teaching kids Catalan, he said, you will eventually cause the language to disappear. That worry has been exacerbated by a recent linguistic survey. It found that Spanish is the main language in nearly half of households in Catalonia. Catalan accounts for less than a third. Yet amidst the bookstalls that lined Barcelona sidewalks yesterday, talk was mostly of peaceful coexistence. Well-known Catalan journalist Lluís Foix was out signing copies of his latest book in Catalan entitled La Força dels Arrels, or The Strength of Our Roots. It's a collection of essays on life and culture in the Catalan countryside.
Jo crec que no està baixant. El que passa que hi ha un gran desplaçament demogràfic, hi ha molta immigració que ve.
I don't think Catalan use is decreasing, he said. It's just that we have a lot of immigrants who've just arrived here from other places, and it takes time to assimilate them. Still, some Catalan defenders say acting as if Catalan and Spanish were on equal footing is wrong. Only 8 million people speak Catalan versus hundreds of millions of Spanish speakers in Spain and around the world. Sant Jordi might have slain the much bigger dragon, they say, but that's a legend. Yesterday's reality, writer Javier Cercas' latest book, in Spanish, was Sant Jordi's top seller on the streets. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Three more Chinese astronauts are now aboard China's space station. They're part of a crew rotation to replace the three astronauts currently on board. Each crew member serves about 6 months. The Shenzhou 20 spacecraft took off from a launch site on the edge of the Gobi Desert this evening, local time, and it docked at the space station 6.5 hours later. That's according to China's manned space agency.
China's Tiangong space station was fully assembled back in 2022. The country was blocked from participating in the International Space Station, the ISS, because the U.S. said it had national security concerns. So China has been developing its own space station.
China put its first astronauts into space in 2003, making it the third country to do so. Its space program has advanced steadily ever since. China has long-term goals to put a person on the moon by the end of the decade and eventually to explore Mars.
Russia launched another deadly attack in Ukraine overnight. This time, the target was the capital city of Kyiv. A combination of drones and missiles hit residential areas, killing at least 12 people and injuring more than 90. In a post online, President Trump said he's not happy with the Russian strikes on Kyiv and wrote that the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, needs to stop. The World's Daniel Offman has more for us. Daniel, what is the latest on last night's attack?
Well, this was a big attack. This was the deadliest attack on Kyiv since July of last year. And this morning, there were videos circulating online of first responders clearing debris, looking for people trapped under the rubble. Medics were on site as well, caring for those injured. In Ukraine, just to give a bit of context, in recent weeks, there have been multiple mass casualty attacks like this from Russia. There was the attack in Kryvyi Rih earlier this month that killed 19 people. And just last week on Palm Sunday, 35 people were killed in Sumy. So despite the peace negotiations that are going on, there doesn't seem to be a lull in Russian drone and missile strikes on Ukraine.
So this is the worst and latest of a recent onslaught. At the time of the attack, President Zelensky was in South Africa. He quickly announced that he would be cutting his trip short and returning to Ukraine. What was Zelensky doing there in South Africa?
Well, going back to the beginning of the full-scale invasion, many of Ukraine's allies and partners immediately came to support Ukraine with financial aid, military aid, or otherwise. And at the same time, many countries in the global south, especially in Africa, didn't condemn Russia's full-scale invasion. And there are many reasons for that. Some of these countries, they have historic, diplomatic, or economic ties with Russia, some of them even going back to the Soviet Union. So the Ukrainian government has this effort going to focus on countries like South Africa to counter Russia's narrative about Ukraine. And that's what Zelensky's trip was all about, shoring up diplomatic support more widely beyond Europe.
And of course, there are these ceasefire talks, the peace negotiations you were talking about that the U.S. has been trying to lead also with Europe. Where do those talks stand?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk around the negotiations in recent weeks. So let's start with what we're hearing from the U.S. Here's what Vice President J.D. Vance said yesterday when he was asked about the negotiations.
We've issued a very explicit proposal to both the Russians and the Ukrainians, and it's time for them to either say yes or for the United States to walk away from this process.
So we heard there that there's some frustration about how the negotiations are going and a lack of patience with Ukraine and also with Russia. One of the key sticking points has to do with the status of territory that's occupied by Russia. Here's what Vance had to say about that.
The current line, somewhere close to them, is where you're ultimately, I think, going to draw the new lines in the conflict. Now, of course, that means the Ukrainians and the Russians are both going to have to give up some of the territory they currently own. There's going to have to be some territorial swaps.
Territorial swaps, Daniel. Vance, I gather, did not explain exactly what he means by that, but how are Ukrainian officials responding to that statement, that idea?
Well, not very positively at all. One of the points that's been reported about Trump's proposed deal would be for Ukraine to officially recognize Russian control of Crimea. Reporters asked Zelensky about Crimea yesterday. Here's what he said.
Україна не визнає юридичну окупацію Криму. Ми маємо про що говорити. Це поза нашою конституцією.
He said, we don't even need to discuss it. Ukraine does not legally recognize the occupation of Crimea. It's against our constitution. So for Ukraine, this is a non-starter. It's a red line that it won't cross. And in an online post, President Trump called Zelensky's statement, quote, very harmful for peace negotiations. He went on to say that Crimea was lost years ago and accused Zelensky of prolonging the war. Trump's critics have said that these kinds of statements make it seem like he's aligning himself with Russia in these negotiations.
So Crimea, Russia occupied in what, 2014? Why are they so central to these negotiations?
Well, it's what you just said, Carolyn. The war started in Crimea. Russian troops entered Crimea in 2014 and later illegally annexed it. And now, with the full-scale war, it's doing the same with another four Ukrainian territories. For Putin, official recognition of Crimea as part of Russia would be a major victory. From his point of view, it would essentially legalize his invasion, and it would be the ultimate capitulation. So for the same reason, Crimea is also highly significant for Ukraine. As Zelensky said, Ukraine cannot legalize legally recognize the occupation of its territory. And that says a lot about where the negotiations stand in general. The proposed deal, it's highly unfavorable for Ukraine. And on the other side, Russia isn't budging from its positions. So that's why officials like J.D. Vance and others in the Trump administration, they're signaling that they're willing to walk away from this effort altogether.
The World's Daniel Offman is in Washington. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Once a year in Israel, the country comes to a standstill for a moment of reflection. A siren in honor of the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. Today is Yom HaShoah, or Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's been 80 years since the Holocaust ended. The survivors now are almost all gone. As the World's Sarah Birnbaum explains, it's now up to their grandchildren, the third generation, to tell their stories.
Aaron Tartakovsky wasn't alive during the Holocaust, but it still governs his life.
I am a grandchild of Holocaust survivors. My Holocaust ancestry actually influences everything that I choose to do in life.
Tartakovsky's grandmother was from Russia. His grandfather was from Poland. They met in hiding and then ended up in the same displaced persons camp in Germany after the war.
My grandfather had a family before the war. So he had a wife and he had a little girl and a little boy. All three of them were killed, and we've counted so far 214 members of our family were murdered.
Eventually, they made it to America and then made an unusual choice.
They heard about a community in, of all places, South Jersey, where there was a community of Holocaust survivors who all had become chicken farmers.
A place called Vineland, New Jersey. His family didn't have an agricultural background. His father was actually from a well-established business family.
They had a big leather goods empire. They were kind of like the Ferragamos of Poland. And all of a sudden, he became a chicken farmer. And so people would ask him, you know, Yosel, what are you doing on a chicken farm? And he said in Yiddish, mit dechine li defnish redenke English, which means, well, with chickens, you don't have to speak English.
When Tartakovsky was a kid, he didn't tell people where he grew up in San Francisco that his grandparents were Holocaust survivors. Not because he was embarrassed and not because he was worried about anti-Semitism.
The main reason why was that it was just so deeply personal and so deeply painful. I almost didn't want to burden others. You know, how do you casually talk about over 200 members of my own family were murdered? It's just such an unfathomable level of loss.
Tartakovsky only started sharing as he got older.
Especially as the survivors enter the twilight of their lives, I feel a certain obligation to, as a living connection to that history, to tell that history.
He runs a group for other grandchildren of Holocaust survivors and has made a documentary with his family about his grandparents. The third generation has been speaking out for years, but it's only recently that their stories have taken center stage. The clearest example is Jesse Eisenberg's film A Real Pain, which just won 2 Oscars. In that movie, 2 cousins go on a Holocaust memorial tour to Poland. In this scene, David, who's Eisenberg's character, is at a restaurant with his Jewish heritage tour group. His cousin Benji has had yet another outburst and has left the table.
I mean, he's always been like up and down, you know, like he's sensitive and he like sees people so clearly, you know, but then you say the wrong thing and like something switches. Or maybe it's not appropriate to talk about him.
No, no, what's not appropriate? You obviously got something going on between you and he's clearly in pain.
Yeah, but isn't everyone in pain in some way? I mean, look at what happened to our families. Look at where we came from. I mean, who isn't, you know, who isn't rot?
Well, you seem okay.
I'm not, though. I'm not. I just, like, take a pill for my f***ing OCD, you know? And I jog, and I meditate, and I go to work in the morning, and I, like, come home at the end of the day, and I, like, move forward, you know? Because I know that my pain is unexceptional.
Andrew Greenwald can't remember a time when he didn't know about the Holocaust.
My grandfather would tell me stories about the war and the camps and his family from when I was very young, very, very young.
All 4 of his grandparents are survivors, and when he was little, he spent a lot of time hanging out with them and all their friends, who are also all Holocaust survivors.
There was nobody in that group, whether it be like the people who I would go see in Temple with them or who would be at my grandparents on a weekend or for a birthday party. Nobody was not a character.
There is a lot of drama and a lot of love. Greenwald is a new father, and he just wishes his son Cedar could have known them.
You know, I kind of wish that Cedar could have experienced the feeling of that community and just being ensconced in it and like feeling the feeling of tension and camaraderie and pain and joy and complexity, and also just like the sheer chutzpah and personality.
Greenwald says their lives were inspiring.
Out of the horrors and the will to survive and to remember their families that they lost, they're going to come to a new land. They're going to create a family of their own. They're going to love that family, maybe sometimes a little bit too much and a little too hard, and expect maybe a little bit too much from those people. But there's like an intensity there that's just totally invigorating and a huge point of strength.
He hopes to pass that down to his son. Andrew Greenwald and the others are the last generation who will ever know the survivors and hear their stories firsthand. And it's not just the stories he wants to pass down. It's the feeling of being with them, of sitting on his grandparents' floor, surrounded by brave, complicated, and traumatized people. He just hopes he can convey it properly. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For years, National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek has traversed thousands of miles on every continent, all on foot. But of course, if you're traveling around the world, you're going to encounter many bodies of water. When that happens, Salopek typically hops on board a big ship. Those are waves crashing against a cargo ship that Paul took across the Caspian Sea, one part of his global trek that forced him off land. Paul Salopek joins us to tell us more about his experiences crossing Earth's watery horizons. So over the past 13 years, Paul, you've been walking in the pathways of the first humans who explored the world during the Stone Age. A lot has changed on the planet since then, but one thing that has not is that seas and oceans remain a major obstacle to foot travel. How did our ancestors handle that?
You know, in short, nobody really knows. Not for the long blue water crossings anyway. One scientist told me that earlier species of hominins like Neanderthals stopped at beaches and just turned left or right. But our crazy species, Homo sapiens, were the first to begin kind of pushing logs into the surf. If you can imagine the scene.
Right.
And just disappearing over the horizon again and again until maybe someone actually reached an offshore island or cape or something. So seas may have been lower back then, but archaeologists sort of think that ancient people might have used bamboo rafts to kind of reach Australia from Southeast Asia. Maybe the early colonizers of the Americas might have used, like, dugout canoes. But the trouble is these artifacts don't last very long, and they rot away, so nobody really knows.
Since we began these conversations, Paul, this is one aspect of your movement that has fascinated me, because you don't use planes, cars, trains, or other motorized travel, but you do hop aboard cargo ships and ferries along your walking route whenever you bump into large bodies of water. Why not just fly?
You know, flying is my last resort. I mean, so here's why. So I'm trying to keep my body in contact with the surface of the earth as I do my own migration. Like the ancient people. So my default travel when I'm not walking is by ship on seas. And, you know, besides, you kind of meet interesting characters at sea.
Well, one of the interesting characters you met aboard a ship was the engineer of what's known as a camel boat. You hitched a ride on this to cross the Red Sea from Djibouti in the Horn of Africa to the port of Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. So this engineer was listening to bird songs on a laptop when you met him. Paul, set the scene here. What was going on with this engineer running this camel boat?
Yeah, this was aboard the Abu Yasser II, which was carrying about 8,000 sheep and 900 camels from Africa to Saudi. And the engineer's name was Jamal Osili. And he was part of a Syrian crew that were basically homeless, kind of forever circling the Red Sea because of the civil war back home in Syria. They really couldn't go home. It was a very kind of melancholic mood on this ship, beside the fact that these animals are going for slaughter, right? It was kind of the anti-ark. But Jamal was listening to canary singing competitions that were posted online from places like Syria and Algeria.
Wow.
To cheer himself up. And I didn't even know that these existed, that there were kind of caged birds competing at singing, but they were. And it just struck me as this kind of perfect, bittersweet moment that embodied his own kind of prisoner status at sea and his homesickness.
I have this memory that in Syria, keeping birds in cages is kind of quite common. I wonder if that's a moment of nostalgia for him.
Yeah, I think it goes way back. It's in Persian culture, right? The appreciation of bird songs. So yeah, he was trying to keep in touch with home, I think.
A moment ago, Paul, we heard waves crashing against the ship that you were aboard crossing the Caspian Sea between Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. You were riding along with Turkish truckers on this night ferry. That has got to be a sea passage I doubt we'll find on most tour ship itineraries. What was that like?
That was indeed off the beaten track. I hit the Caspian. I couldn't get around it because in the north there was trouble in Chechnya, and in the south I couldn't get a visa to go through Iran. So I had to take a ship over. It was a night passage on a charcoal dark sea. And this boat was crammed with Turkish truck drivers in their trucks. They had kind of congregated in the galley, and they were being kind of overseen and kept on a straight line there by a very severe woman steward. But still, I noticed when we reached Aktau, Kazakhstan, to disembark, a few of them were a little tipsy. So they were going to present kind of a highway peril going wow. into Central Asia. But the thing that struck me, the beauty of that particular sea passage was I felt like I was really kind of on a modern version of the Silk Road, right? Because these truckers were carrying kind of European goods all the way into Central Asia through Kazakhstan, you know, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan. So I felt like I was almost at a caravanserai that was floating across the Caspian.
Wow, that is so cool. So were these truckers sleeping on this overnight passage, or were they drinking, or what was going on while you were on board?
I think they were probably supposed to be sleeping, right? Because as soon as they got off in Kazakhstan, they would have like, you know, days of driving ahead across the steppes of Central Asia. But some were carousing, some were kind of obviously had smuggled a little alcohol on board. Yeah, so maybe a few corners, some parties are going on the ship.
So I just learned, Paul, that you once worked as a deep sea fisherman, which I suppose should not surprise me. What did that experience do to your level of readiness when you had to take some of these very utilitarian ship passages?
You know, I loved it. I have very strong, good memories about working at sea. I worked in the North Pacific on scallopers. I worked in the Indian Ocean on shrimpers. So it was kind of a nice break. You know, I'm walking for years across continents to kind of take the backpack off and drop it on a deck somewhere and watch the sea slide by, often much faster than I walk, right? Even the slowest ferries are going much faster than a walk. It was kind of exhilarating and a little bit like a homecoming for me. So they were pleasant. I liked it.
And now you're about to leave Japan, where you're speaking to us from, for Alaska aboard a gigantic 1,000-foot container ship. It's going to carry you thousands of miles across the North Pacific. I mean, these are the types of monster vessels that transport most of the world's consumer goods today. What can you tell us about this megaship and how you think it might change the ocean-going experience?
I think this is going to be very different, Marco. As you mentioned, this ship is like as long as a 3 football fields. It's just enormous. I'll be able to kind of jog around it. I won't have to stop walking. I can just do circuits on deck. It'll take 12 days to cross the North Pacific. This particular ship is Danish, and it'll be carrying 9,000 containers. And it's kind of the classic modern caravan camel, if you will, of the early 21st century. Globalization now, our global trade, 80% is carried by these gigantic vessels.
You know, I've just been reading about the drop in shipments from Asia to North America due to tariffs from the White House and retaliatory tariffs. Do you know if the ship is going to leave on time or if it will be at capacity?
This is one part of the modern world that is very in sync with my kind of low-tech walking world, is that I don't know, right? Because it's incumbent on trade. So there's a sailing date out of Yokohama, Japan, and it's provisional for now, and I won't know till I get there. Hopefully it will sail.
And you're in Tokyo right now. When do you get to Yokohama? Let's remember, you are on foot.
That's right. So I'll get to Yokohama probably at the end of May. I've got a bit of walking to do ahead. There's a few hundred kilometers along the route that I'm taking.
Paul Salopek is a National Geographic explorer on a years-long walking journey. He joined us from Japan. Paul, thank you very much. Safe travels.
Great, Marco. Always, always glad to chat.
That is going to do it for us today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world.
MacFound.org by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.